Well, good morning, everyone. I'd like you to imagine that you've got a legal document in front of you. So maybe the title deed to your house or your mortgage documents from the bank. And there's a particular style of a document like that, isn't there? It's written in a certain kind of language, a certain kind of very technical language. And really, if you wanted to understand that document, well, you wouldn't speed read it. It would be something that you'd have to look over very carefully to understand the balance of the different phrases. And there might even be words in there that aren't even used in normal life. My own house is more than 200 years old, and the title deed to the original part of that house has some words in that I simply just don't know what they mean. Well, that's one type of writing, and then you could compare legal writing like that to, let's say, a romantic novel, and that would be quite different. You could read that much easier, you could be relaxed, you could speed read it, you could read it pretty quickly. Or then think again about a newspaper or about a poem. Each of those different types of writing have their own conventions. They have potentially even their own vocabulary, their own structures, their own mechanisms by which they work. And it wouldn't make any sense, would it, to read the newspaper or a romantic novel as if you were reading a legal document. Similarly, a poem, you can't speed read a poem. It's something that you have to take time over. You have to let the phrases sit there in your mind and wash over, as it were, in your consciousness to come to a sense of what it is that the poet is trying to say. Well, it's just the same in the Bible, perhaps not quite the contrast that we were drawing there, but reading Leviticus is not the same as reading a narrative account such as the Gospels or one of the historical accounts of the Old Testament. And that, again, is different to reading the prophets, and it's different to reading, and now we get to our subject, to reading the Psalms. When we read the Psalms, what we're doing is reading poetry. And there's a particular approach that we need to take to that in order to understand what it is that the Psalms are communicating to us. Now, that might be a bit of a cause of alarm, at least for some of us. I'm not sure what kind of experience you had with poetry at school, but for some of us, it wasn't necessarily a particularly good experience. Poetry can seem quite a scary thing. And perhaps some of the problem is, you know, we're just too young, really, at that stage to have had the life experiences, to have had enough thoughts of and reactions of different kinds to slow down enough to really appreciate what a poem is saying. Excuse me. So, in terms of my own experience of poetry, I've got to get some water. So my own experience of poetry at school, it wasn't a particularly bad experience, but it wasn't a particularly good experience either. It wasn't something that I particularly enjoyed. And perhaps, you know, to a young boy in his early teens, you know, the language seems all a bit too flowery, a bit too airy-fairy, perhaps. But as I say, perhaps poetry can become more interesting to us as our experience grows. Certainly it has for me. In any case, take heart, even if you were not the person who was particularly into poetry, Bible poetry is not the same as English poetry, and in a few moments we'll get on to some of the differences between them. It is important, though, it is important for us to be able to understand and appreciate Bible poetry, because so much of the Bible is actually written in poetry. We're not talking about just the Psalms, we're also talking about most of the book of Proverbs, most of Ecclesiastes, all of the Song of Songs, most of the book of Job, by far the majority of Job, and also a good chunk of the prophetic writings are also written in a poetic style. And even some of the narratives have poetic features about them. Sometimes you can just be reading along in a narrative account and the writer will switch into a more heightened poetic style where some of the features that are characteristic of Bible poetry come to the fore. So to have a measure of understanding of how the poetry in the Bible works out can be very valuable and can help us to be better readers of the Bible. Well, let's slip back to English poetry for a second before we join the dots across to Hebrew poetry. What is it that makes a poem a poem? Well, the first thing we might think of is rhyme, isn't it? Poems should rhyme. Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night, or in the version that I prefer, tiger, tiger, burning bright, how can you see without a light? To separate your foes from friendies, you must be wearing contact lenses. Rather irreverent version of the original poem there. And obviously there's a pretty clear rhyme scheme. And you can also see the problem of rhyme, because it creates contrivances. Friendies isn't a word, but it's been made into that so that it rhymes with lenses. And sometimes rhyme in English poetry can bring about, if the poem is not a particularly good one, an element of artificiality to it, where the words are made to fit so that the rhyme scheme works. Well, interestingly, there is no rhyme in Hebrew poetry. But we'll come back to that. Another thing we might think of is meter. And so there are these rather unpleasant terms such as iambic pentameter and so forth that refer to different rhythm patterns in English poetry. But think of it like this. Think of a limerick. Da 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 da. That's the basic rhythm pattern for a limerick, and the sonnet has a different rhythm pattern. And once we start into that, we know where it's going to go. It has a certain shape. Well, there isn't really rhythm or meter as a significant component of Hebrew poetry either. In fact, scholars are still debating whether there is rhythm in Hebrew poetry, and they can't even decide whether they should be counting syllables or whether they should be counting beats as rhythmic units. And the very fact that they're still debating those questions shows you that rhythm isn't very important, if it even exists at all, as a defining feature of Hebrew poetry. Now, that's very interesting, because if you take an English poem that rhymes and has a rhythm to it, and you translate it into French or into Hebrew or Serbo-Croat, what you'll find is it doesn't rhyme anymore, and the rhythm that it used to have, it no longer possesses. So those features of language don't easily translate into other languages. When we think about what makes Bible poetry poetry, however, what God has done is he's picked a language whose poetry has features that easily translate into other languages. Let's just continue our exploration of what makes a poem a poem. Another one might be sound play. So think about this from Thomas Hardy, I think. And as the smart ship grew in stature, grace and hue, in shadowy silent distance grew the iceberg too. And you can hear the repetitions of the sh sounds and the s sounds as the iceberg and the ship come together. Now, just occasionally you get a little bit of that in Hebrew poetry. So Psalm 1 verse 1, blessed is the man, in Hebrew sounds Ashrei ha'ish asher, and you can hear the repetition of the sh 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 sounds there. But by and large, that sort of thing doesn't happen very often in Hebrew. Again, it's not a feature that translates from one language to another, and the Bible doesn't really use it very much either. So what does Bible poetry look like? What are the features that it uses? Well, one of them is repetition. And of course, we're used to looking for repeated words and key words in our Bible studies. And if we look in the Psalms and other Bible poetry, this feature is to be found all over the place. And the great thing is, you take a word and you repeat it, you translate it into another language, the repetition works there too, by and large. So this translates easily. Imagery, the use of images, and we'll look at some examples in a minute, that again is something that translates very easily. Sometimes also the Bible uses structure and shape, so you get structural patterns within a poem, and these too can be translated. And the use of heightened language, words that you wouldn't normally have chosen, juxtapositions of things that at first don't seem to quite fit together, but when you think about it a bit more, actually, perhaps in a certain way they do. And it's the setting up of that disjunction that creates the interest in the piece of writing. So it's a great example of God picking the right tools for the job, isn't it? If the Bible had originally been written in English and it had used a lot of rhyme and rhythm and sound play, well, we would have lost all that when we translated it into other languages. But instead, God has chosen Hebrew poetry for the most part of the Bible, and that translates very easily into any language that you care to name. But why use poetry at all? And this is the last bit of our sort of introductory thoughts. Well, one writer put it like this, that a poem evokes thoughts which are oft thought, but ne'er so well expressed. So things that we already know, that we're familiar with, but which just expresses them with a crispness and a sharpness that is unsurpassed, that is unique, that picks a thing out and enables us to say, yeah, that's right, that's exactly how it is. That's what poetry does. Another way of thinking about it is that it takes our perception of an object and transforms it so that we can see an old thing in a new way. It can heighten our perception of things. It can make us translate facts and statements into feelings. It can make us feel what something is like, feel the emotions of a thing, not just the facts about it. It's a bit like the difference between a 2D printer, you know, that prints words on a page, and then those words coming to life and having a 3D printer that produces the solid object. And the poetry is like that. It's like words coming to life in pictures in front of us. Well, all that was a bit theoretical, wasn't it, and abstract. Why don't we try and make it real by actually taking an example from the Psalms now? And we're going to take Psalm 6. And you'll see on the handout there on page 1, we've got Psalm 6. And on the top left, that's what it looks like in the page of my Bible, which is the Authorized Version. Now, the problem with that is that it doesn't look much like a poem, does it? So the first thing we need to do is to change it so that it looks like a poem, just to put it into poetic lines, which some of the modern versions do. And you see, I've done that underneath, just taken the Authorized Version text, so the words are exactly the same, and we've just put it into poetic lines, and that's actually quite a useful exercise. And now I've picked the AV here, and I don't want to get this into a discussion about Bible versions. You know, the AV is the Bible that I normally use for my sort of, Bible study work. But there are two reasons in particular in relation to the Psalms why I think it's helpful. And one of them is because the language is different, because this is not the language that we use every day, it helps you to remember the words. It's much easier to recall. It sticks in your memory because the words are unique.
Because it's memorable. Because it uses different language to our everyday language, I find it puts hooks in my memory and I remember its phrases much more effectively. I can call it to mind. I can memorize it much more effectively than I can if I read in a modern version. So that's one of the reasons. The second reason is that the Hebrew is not always easy to understand. We don't always know what it means. And it might mean this or it might mean that. And particularly with poetry, I mean, who's familiar with the poetry of Ted Hughes? Who's ever had to look at the poetry of Ted Hughes? Anybody? Nobody? Wow. Oh, there we are. We have someone. Fantastic. Well, I mean, you know that it's not easy, is it? It's not easy. And yet here we're dealing with poetry which is far older and which has some words where, you know, we're not quite sure what those words mean necessarily in all cases. Now, the great thing about the AV is when the Hebrew is difficult, the AV is difficult also. So it tells you that there's something going on here. And you need to have a look into this. You need to have a think about this. You need to perhaps go and do some extra study about what the possibilities are of what this might mean. What tends to happen if you read a modern version is that if there is a difficulty, the modern version will give you one interpretation of how to resolve that difficulty, which may or may not be the right one. So, of course, it's useful to use the modern versions to see what those interpretations might be. But for me, if there is a difficulty in the original, or if there's some uncertainty about what it means, I'd rather know that. I'd rather my translation shows me that. And this is particularly the case in poetry, where sometimes cryptic things are said. I don't want the translator to smooth over the cryptic things and make it all seem simple if the original isn't simple. I'd rather know and then have the opportunity to weigh in my mind and through further Bible study try and work out what the meaning might be. Now, there's a problem, though, isn't there? Because if you do use the AV and it looks like what that top left there looks like, it doesn't look like a poem at all, does it? It just looks like a block of text. So it's hard to have your poetry head on when you're looking at text that looks like that. So what I like to do is get the text on the computer, you know, either type it in or use some software or something, get the text, and then put it into poetic lines. And that's, you can see, what we've done on the bottom left there. It's exactly the same as the top left, Psalm 6, but I've just broken it down into the poetic lines. And now it's starting to look like a poem, isn't it? Now, I realize that a lot of the modern versions do lineate the poetry in this way, so they do have that advantage. But for me, I just find it really powerful to get it on the computer, get it on a piece of paper, and then to work from that for my Bible study. So here is the psalm, and what I'd like you to do, and we'll just take a couple of minutes to do this, is I'd like you to translate the psalm, not into another language, but into non-poetic language, to try and strip away the imagery, strip away the repetition, and just think about what is the essential point. You know, try to convert this psalm into bullet points, if you like. And I think that's a very interesting exercise to do because it helps you start to think about what's special about the psalm as a psalm, and to help us see that it's more than just the content, it's more than just the facts of what is said, it's the way it says it which is powerful, which is important, and which is inspired, of course. So we're going to uninspire the psalm, if you like, and you say, well, why would you want to do that? Well, you know, I don't want to spend a lot of time doing this, but it is an interesting exercise just to make that comparison, to see what the form of the writing, what the way that the Spirit has expressed it as a poem, what difference that makes. So you'll say, I've done that for the first paragraph. So the psalm says, O Lord, rebuke me not in thine anger, neither chasten me in thy hot displeasure. And I've simplified that down to, Lord, do not be too angry with me. And similarly, take pity on me. I am weak and need help. How long will I wait? Now, that's a lot shorter, isn't it? It's a lot shorter. So if you just take a pen and just have a go maybe at the next couple of stanzas, we won't have time to do the full thing. You might want to complete that in your own time. But just have a go at the next couple of stanzas there and keep it as simple as you possibly can. Put down the minimum that you can put down to express the basic content or message of what the psalm's saying. Okay, let me break in at that point because I don't want to take too long on this. But and I just picked that psalm at random, so you can do this with any psalm that you like, and hopefully you could see that there's no wrong or right answers to this, right? It's just an attempt to understand what it is that the form that the scriptures have used is brings to the party, what it's adding to the basic message of the psalm. I'll just read you a couple of lines. This is just my attempt to do some of the lines you've been looking at. Come back, Lord, and save me. I am going to die and will not be able to praise you when death comes. I am tired of groaning and crying all night. My enemies are making me sad. Go away, wicked people. God has heard me. God has listened to my prayer. I hope all my enemies will soon be defeated. And in the way that's very basic English, isn't it? It's the language that a child might use or might understand. It strips away some of the imagery, the depth of feeling. And in a way, we flattened it, haven't we? By doing that exercise, we flattened the psalm and taken away so much of its beauty and its power. And that beauty and power comes because of the imagery that's used, because of the parallelism, because of the way the psalm makes you feel something that our simplified versions don't make you feel, do they? That's what the difference is. So let's step into that in a little bit more detail to look at that question, how is it a poem? What makes it a poem? Well, think about the imagery in verse 6 and 7. I am weary with my groaning. All the night make I my bed to swim. Now, that's a pretty graphic image, isn't it? He's turned his bed into a swimming pool. That's the amount of tears that he's crying. That's how sad, how upset, how devastated he is. I water my couch with my tears. So his bed is now, he's shifted from being a swim pool. Now it's a garden, isn't it, that he's watering. Instead of using the hose pipe, it's his tears that he's watering his garden with. Verse 7, my eye is consumed with grief. It waxes old because of my... He can feel himself age as he's lying there, tossing and turning, fretting about this situation that's causing him such anxiety. He can feel his eye consuming away in its socket, as it were, through these feelings of devastation that he has. So the psalm speaks to us, doesn't it? Once we stop to think about the phrases, that it reaches out and it grabs us and makes us feel something. The victimization of verse 1. O Lord, rebuke me not in thine anger, neither chasten me in thy hot displeasure, as though God has something against him, is victimizing him there. Verse 2, the aching of his body. Have mercy upon me, O Lord, for I am weak. O Lord, heal me, for my bones are vexed. This aching of his bones. And it's that psychosomatic thing, isn't it? Where, you know, we're not detached, are we? Where there's a part of us that has thoughts and feelings, and there's our physical body. You know, more and more we've come to understand that these two things are completely connected, aren't they? And here it is right there in Psalm 6. His distress and his grief makes him physically ill, makes him feel physical pain. That's how upset he is. The abandonment of verse 4, return, O Lord, deliver my soul, O save me for thy mercy's sake. The weight of death in verse 5, for in death there is no... Why are we suddenly talking about death? We didn't know he was dying, did we? And he's probably not dying, but his sorrow turns his heart to those sort of morbid thoughts. What's the point? That weight of death comes down upon him and feels closer than perhaps it really is. In the grave, who shall give thee thanks? The inescapable grief of verses 6 and 7 that we've already talked about. And yet then we have this strange juxtaposition in verse 8, don't we? Depart from me, all ye workers of iniquity, for the Lord has heard the voice of my weeping. The Lord has heard my supplication. The Lord will receive my prayer. So it's like suddenly now he gets some energy back from somewhere, doesn't he? He finds himself again. He musters some courage, and his confidence returns to him for a moment to express these sentiments at the end of the psalm. And it is like that, isn't it? When we're upset about something, we don't just have, you know, one continuous stream of thoughts, do we? We flip and we flop between feeling devastated one moment and then thinking, oh, perhaps it'll be okay. Well, I'm going to be able to make it through, and then we're down again the next moment. This is real life, isn't it? This is what it is like to be a person, to feel these things, these swings in our feelings and our emotions. And the final feature that I want to pick out from this psalm, and one which is important in all Bible poetry, or nearly all, is this feature called parallelism. Let's take a look at that. Verse 1, again. O Lord, rebuke me not in thine anger, neither chasten me in thy hot displeasure. Now, those two lines stand in parallel to each other, don't they? He says one thing, and then he says something very similar to it in the second line. And as I say, most Hebrew poetry works like that. You get two lines in parallel with each other. So the rebuke me of the first line stands with neither chasten me in the second line. The anger of the first line stands with the hot displeasure of the second line. And it's exactly the same in verse 2. Have mercy upon me, O Lord, for I am weak. O Lord, heal me. That stands with have mercy on me, for my bones are vexed. My bones are vexed stands with the I am weak, doesn't it? It's all arranged into these sets of pairs, these parallel lines. And you can see the same thing in verse 3, and the same thing in verse... Well, verse 3 is interesting, right? Because this time, the parallelism works a little bit differently, doesn't it? My soul is sore vexed, but thou, O Lord, how long? And this time, the parallelism is one of contrast, isn't it? My soul is vexed, but thou, Lord, what are you doing about it, Lord? How can you leave me in this position of feeling so wretched? That's the pivot, isn't it, in those two lines. Verse 7, my eye is consumed with grief. It waxes old because of my enemies. Always these pairs of lines. And this is perhaps the most characteristic feature of Bible poetry. Now, in order to grasp what's going on here, it's helpful to think about numbers. I'm going to read you four verses of these parallel lines, and you'll notice that in each line of these verses, there are two numbers, and I'd like you to notice what's different about the numbers. So here's example one. If Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 70 and sevenfold. Here's example two. How should one chase 1,000 and two put 10,000 to flight? What's different about the numbers? Here is another one. That our sheep may bring forth thousands and 10,000s in our streets. And here's a final one. Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. What's the difference between the numbers in each example? They increase, don't they? Yeah. It wouldn't be for three transgressions of Samaria and for two, would it? It would always be that the second one is a bigger number. It wouldn't be if Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, then Lamech sixfold. That would just wouldn't work, would it? It would be silly if it was that way around. The second number is always bigger. And what almost always happens in the Bible poetry is that the second line of the parallel pair is an intensification. It's bigger. It's more graphic. It's more intense. Now, it's not always the case. Sometimes it is just a synonym, you know, it's just a parallel, the two phrases stand equally. But often, it's the more graphic version in the second line. So you say one thing, and then you say it again, more emphatically, more strongly. And that's really the key to this aspect of parallelism. Right, we've got three topics still to talk about in this session. We're going to talk about repetition, imagery, and shape. So let's start with repetition, and we'll go to Psalm 47. Let's start very simply. We're going to read verses 6 and 7, and you're going to tell me what's repeated here. Sing praises to God. Sing praises. Sing praises unto our King. Sing praises, for God is the King of all the earth. Sing ye praises with understanding. What's repeated? Sing praises, right? It couldn't be much more emphatically repeated than that, could it? He's put it in, the psalmist has put it in as many times as he possibly could into those two lines. However, it's not just those two lines. I'd like you to read through the psalm and just note down how many references there are to rejoicing in some way, to making a noise, to singing praises, to exalting God. Just have a quick scan through. How many did you get? Yeah, somewhere around that, isn't it? High single digits. Let's not worry too much about the exact number. It's like the wild beasts again. But it's emphatic, isn't it? So what's this psalm about then? Well, it's pretty clear what it's about, isn't it? And so the scriptures tell us, don't they, what to focus on. And one of the ways that they tell us is by repetition, key terms being repeated. And of course, we're familiar with that as Bible students, aren't we? We're not left to guess what this is about. The repetition tells us, but it's often surprising just how emphatic that is. I mean, I think, you know, if we hadn't been talking about repetition and we'd just read the psalm, you know, we would have known that it was about praising God. And yet, as soon as we've started to actually spot it and write down all the references, it's actually more about that than we thought, isn't it? It's even more emphatic, because it's not a long psalm. We're only talking about a psalm of 9 verses here, aren't we? And that's quite a lot of emphasis on that subject. And you know what I find really helpful here in my own Bible study, again, is, as I say, to just have the psalm, you know, like we set out Psalm 6 there on the sheet, to have it printed out on a piece of paper and just circle all the words that are repeated. So we've done that. We've looked at one set of repetitions, but that's not the only set of ideas that are repeated in this psalm. Just have another scan through it again and see if you can see any other ideas or concepts that are repeated in this psalm. Anyone want to volunteer anything? Nations and peoples. Yeah, who spotted that? Good. Yep, excellent. And there's a lot of references to that, isn't there? There's something like 8 references to nations and peoples. So this is a psalm then which is about lifting up our minds and our voices to God, isn't it? So there's a vertical dimension to it in which we give to God what is due to him. But there's also a horizontal dimension to it, isn't there? In which it's not just us, it's all nations and peoples here that are involved. What is happening, whatever occasion it is that has instigated this psalm, is something that is going to affect everyone, ultimately. It's all nations and peoples who are going to be embraced in whatever it is that is happening here, in what this psalm is describing. Good, any others? God is king. Right? Yeah. So this the regal language that's used. Let's have a look at that then. Verse 2. He is a great king over all the earth. Verse 5 is a bit more questionable. God is gone up with a shout. And this is more of a technical one, but some scholars think this word about God going up here is a word that's used in a coronation. Let's leave that one. Verse 6. Sing praises to our king. Sing praises. Verse 7, for God is the king of all the earth. Verse 8, God reigneth over the nations. And in verse 9, we have the reference to princes, don't we? And the shields belonging to God. So again, it's regal language that's used. And it pervades the whole psalm. So in thinking what is the context for this psalm then, we need to have something that incorporates a regal occasion. Don't we? Something that emphasizes the kingship of God. Great. Are there any other phrases or ideas that are repeated? God is in control. Yeah, that's a very important one. So the idea of what is high, because, you know, in a power structure, the one who's on the top of the food chain is the one who's in control, isn't he, in that sense? So think about the height of God. And then think about what is underneath, the up and the down dichotomy. How often can we find that one? Verse 2, for the Lord Most High is terrible. He is a great king over all the earth. Verse 3, he shall subdue. So he's going to be on top, and something is going to be subdued under him. He shall subdue the people under us, and the nations under our feet. Verse 4, possibly the word excellency also has to do with the idea of height. Verse 5, God is gone up with a shout. Verse 8, God reigneth over the heathen. God sitteth upon the throne of his holiness. Verse 9, the shields of the earth, again, belong to the Lord. He is greatly exalted. So the psalm goes out with this very topic, doesn't it? It goes out with a bang of God being exalted over everything. He is in command of everything and everyone, and those who oppose him are subdued under him. So again, you count those up. You know, that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. That's something, 10 references to this up, down. Again, in a psalm that's only 9 verses long. This is really extensive, isn't it? So what I do, you know, what I'd like to do here is just have, again, have the psalm printed out, just circle all the different themes, and then, you know, you underline some others, or maybe you put a square box around some others, and the psalm tells you what it's about, doesn't it? Once you start to spot these repetitions, it's like it comes to life. It's like, oh, wow, this is all the way through the psalm, this idea of God being king, of him being in control, of all the nations being subject to him. And therefore, the praise of us and of all the earth ascending to him as it should. This is how the world is meant to be, isn't it? This is a picture of the goal of God's purpose come to life now before us in this short psalm of 7 verses. So for me, Bible study is less, and increasingly I find this, is less about you know, getting out lots of concordances and lexicons and burying down into meanings of words. You know, I've done my fair share of that sort of Bible study too. And of course, there are many interesting things to learn from doing that. So I wouldn't want to say don't do it, or that that's not interesting, or it's not important. But for me, I found that far more rewarding than that sort of Bible study is the Bible study that just sits there and reads and reads and reads, lets the words, particularly with the poetry, let the words flow over you, spot the repetitions, note them down, think, why is that there? Why is this always being repeated? What's the context for this psalm then that would cause that to be the case? Why are those two ideas put together? Why is that image chosen and not some other? And of course, you don't need any Hebrew or Greek or fancy books to do that kind of study. All you need is a Bible and a pen, or a piece of paper and a pen. And what I find powerful about it is that kind of reflection on the scriptures. Bible study sort of morphs into meditation and morphs into prayer. You know, it's not just a technical exercise. It becomes something more than that, I think. At least that's been my experience. Just very quickly, so what is the context for this psalm then? Well, perhaps the context is the ascension of the ark to Zion, of that being representative of God coming to his home. Here's the up and down, isn't it? As the ark goes up to Zion, the place that God has chosen, the city in which he loves, and God becomes enthroned, as it were, above his people. And then, of course, the conquest, David's conquest of the nations begin, 2 Samuel 8, you know, all the nations become subject to him. And that's how the other nations are impacted, aren't they, by the great work that God is doing, by his presence enthroned as king amongst his people. And that's a little cameo of God's ultimate plan that he'll achieve when Jesus comes back. Well, it's time to move on. Let's look very quickly at imagery, and we'll take Psalm 52 as an example of this. Why boastest thou thyself in mischief, O mighty man? The goodness of God endureth continually. Thy tongue deviseth mischief like a sharp razor working deceitfully. Now, we can just carry on and read on to the next verse, but let's not do that. Let's stop and think. Just think about the imagery that is the image that is just used there in verse 2. Thy tongue deviseth mischief like a sharp razor working deceitfully. Now, what does a tongue have in common with a razor? They're about as unlike each other. You know, tongue is soft and malleable, isn't it? It moves, it shapes, whereas a razor is thin and sharp. You couldn't cut anything with your tongue, could you? Well, of course, yes, you could, but in a different sense. You can't literally cut something with your tongue. But that's the power of it, isn't it? Because it makes you think, but yes, actually, we know a tongue can be like a razor. And it can be like a fire, can't it, as well? And James goes on and uses other imagery about a tongue. But it's like a scalpel, isn't it? You know, the precision of just how, nasty people can be with their tongues. How they can say something which is so cutting, that is so hurtful, and that can never be taken back. You know, something that's always been said, and even though it may be forgiven, it's not forgotten what has been said. That's what a tongue can be like. That's a powerful image to use, isn't it? It's completely unexpected, and yet so effective. Let's just move forward to verse 4. Thou lovest all devouring words, O thou deceitful tongue. Do you see, the tongue is wanting to play at being the teeth, isn't it? A tongue can't devour things. A tongue moves things about in the mouth so that they can get devoured, but it's the teeth that do the devouring. But now the tongue wants to play at being the teeth. And let's carry on. God shall likewise destroy thee forever. He shall take thee away and pluck thee out of thy dwelling place and root thee out of the land of the living. Now we've gone into a horror film, haven't we, in which some kind of clamp is put on the tongue and it's wrenched out of the mouth. That's just disgusting, isn't it, to think about that happening to you. But that's the imagery that's being used, of a tongue being rooted out and plucked out from a mouth. So you better be careful what you say then, hadn't you? And hadn't I? The imagery is brilliant, isn't it? It's absolutely brilliant. But of course, it only works if you stop to unpack it. We have to take the time here. You know, there's no speed reading here. Otherwise, we're just going to miss... we're just going to miss the beauty and the power of these things. Let's finally, and we have run out of time, let's finally go to the sheet and the second page. So we're going to talk about, just stay on the first page for 1 second. We're going to quickly talk about shape. You remember we talked about the shape of a limerick and the shape of a sonnet? Well, no, we don't have time. Second page, sorry. Let's look at the shape of Psalm 58. And I'd like you to look at the first four lines and the last four lines. And I'd just like you to circle any words in the first four lines that are used in the last four lines. And just link them together. Maybe just draw a line between between any words in the first four lines that are used in the last four lines. This is quite remarkable, isn't it? Yeah. What did you get? Anyone like to call any out that they've spotted? Speaking, yeah. Do you indeed speak righteousness, O congregation, so that a man shall say? And they're contrasts, aren't they? Because the point at the beginning is that, no, they're not speaking righteousness at the beginning, are they? But at the end, a man will say, there is a God who judges in the earth. What else? Wicked. Yep. In heart ye work wickedness. He shall wash his feet in the blood of the wicked. Any others? Righteous, righteousness. Any others? Judge and judges. Any others? Which? Earth and earth. Okay. Any others? Sorry, I didn't hear that one. Yea and verily. Good. Yeah. Any others? Sons of man and man. Violence and blood, or violence and vengeance. Yeah. Parts of the body. Hands and feet, right? That's called a merism, right? Like heaven and earth, yeah, top to toe, hands and feet. Stubborn ear. Mm-hmm. Yep, that's right. Yep, yep. Another part of the body. Good. Okay. So there are always two stages to this. One stage is to spot the connections, and in a way, that's the easy bit, isn't it? And this is always worth doing for any psalm. Have a look at the start and have a look at the bottom. Now, there's not always a connection between the two, but there is more times than you would expect. So it's always worth asking that question, and we'll see a few more examples of that as we go through the week. So the second question, though, is what is the point then? So yes, there is clearly a link between the start and the end. What is that link? Well, it's a contrast, isn't it? At the start, the problem is that the wicked are in charge, or seem to be in charge, of God's people, and the wicked are not judging rightly. They are speaking wickedness, and they are miscarrying justice. And this is deeply offensive and unacceptable to God. What is God going to do about it? That is what the psalm is about. The psalmist, in the middle part of the psalm that we don't have time to look at, asks God to do something about it, and asserts that by God stepping in and taking action here, justice will be restored, so that there will be a day when people will say there is a God who judges in the earth. And now people might, you know, we look at the world outside and we see miscarriages of justice and bribery and all kinds of stuff taking place. And people might well ask, you know, is there? And they do ask, you know, how can there be a God when all this is going on? That's that type of thing. And the psalm is asserting here, the day will come when the Lord Jesus Christ returns that people will know and they will see and they will say, verily, there is a God who judges in the earth. So there's a beautiful pattern in the psalm, and then the middle part of the psalm explains how it is that God's going to achieve it. There's all kinds of interesting repetition and things going on in the middle part of the psalm as well that we don't have time to look at, but that's something to, that's some homework.